This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This week, federal rules about birth control and religious institutions prompted a red-hot debate about religious liberty.
I understand some folks in Washington may want to treat this as another political wedge issue. But it shouldn't be. I certainly never saw it that way.
Today, President Barack Obama offered a new plan aimed at ending the outcry, a plan which he says will protect religious freedom and women's access to contraception.
And speaking of compromise, a huge settlement with five banks will provide relief to many Americans stung in the mortgage foreclosure crisis.
The deal is worth some $300 million for Massachusetts homeowners. Is it enough to stabilize the housing market?
There's going to be foreclosure still. Don't make any mistake about that. What we're looking for is to avoid unnecessary foreclosures.
Meanwhile, Washington grants waivers to several states, including Massachusetts, from No Child Left Behind.
And on Beacon Hill, get ready for what looks like a looming budget battle between Governor Deval Patrick and House Speaker Robert DeLeo, who told the governor no new taxes.
We will be releasing a budget that does not rely on any new taxes or any new fees.
And joining us now are two members of our Week in Review panel, Craig Sandler, General Manager of the State House News Service. Hey, Craig.
Happy Friday, Anthony.
Happy Friday to you. Great to see you here. And Dante Ramos is the Deputy Editorial Page Editor of the Boston Globe. And Dante, great to have you on Radio Boston. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday to you. So let's start with today's news from the White House, first of all, in an effort to cool this political firestorm by Catholics and other religious conservatives. President Obama announced a compromise over a federal requirement that religious-affiliated organizations provide insurance coverage for contraception.
If a woman's employer is a charity or a hospital that has a religious objection to providing contraceptive services as part of their health plan, the insurance company, not the hospital, not the charity, will be required to reach out and offer the woman contraceptive care free of charge.
So religious employers will not have to cover birth control for their employees. Instead, insurance companies will, and they'll do it for free. Dante, let me start with you. Is this compromise going to satisfy, for example, the Catholic bishops and other conservatives who objected to the rule to begin with?
It may not satisfy them. They've clearly made a cause out of this and, have at this point kind of dug in on the issue. So I'm not sure if it necessarily will satisfy an argument. Had the administration offered it up in the first place, we might not be even having this discussion right now, because splitting the difference in this way probably would have been the easiest thing, at least politically, for them to do all along.
Yeah. First of all, I mean, earlier this week, the Boston Catholic Archdiocese called that original requirement an attack on religious liberty. Here's Father Brian Hare, the Secretary of Healthcare and Social Services at the Archdiocese of Boston.
You're asking an institution of the church to provide resources for a practice that it has disagreement with. I think that is precisely the point. The institutional issue is what rages the religious freedom issue.
Craig Sandler, do you think, did President Obama miscalculate? I mean, should he have seen this firestorm coming, and did he make a political mistake that he's now trying to sort of walk back from?
Well, you know, I think there's been a lot of walking back during this administration, and that's been an ongoing problem. You'd think after 4 years, they would have learned where to start and with an eye on where they wanted to finish, which again doesn't seem to have been a competent calculation in this case. But originally, no, I actually think that, you know, he now understands who his base is in the general election, I mean, and I think that if anything, it's a, you know, politically, it's a move just to solidify it. You certainly can't blame the Catholic Church for, you know, pursuing its religious ideology via political means. I mean, they're not to be faulted for objecting to a policy proposal they find morally abhorrent. But the fact is that the right wing will argue about it, and conservatives will make hay out of it and attempt to use it. Again, though, it's a case where the waters sort of seem to have been muddied by Obama's political messaging.
Mm. Let's move on to it's the same story. Mitt Romney was among the critics, calling this an assault on religious liberty, but we were reminded this week that as governor, Romney overhauled health care here. He did not change an almost
Classic.
Identical mandate requiring contraceptive coverage by religious employers. Here's Phil Johnston, a former Secretary of Human Services and former chair of the state Democratic Party, who says Romney never tried to repeal the mandate while he was in office.
Never mentioned that it would infringe upon religious freedoms. And during the 4 years that Governor Romney served, he was totally silent about that issue.
Dante, what do you think? Is that a fair point? And is this going to haunt another issue that's going to haunt Romney and his campaign?
Well, it's certainly not the only instance where Romney feels much more vehemently now than he might have when he was governor. It seems to me that Romney's stance has been that he was against all insurance mandates, and this is the kind of thing that in the muddle of a general election campaign, if he gets that far, you know, it ends up being too detailed a discussion to really gain a whole lot of traction. You know, there's some extent where this probably this whole controversy helps his effort to portray Obama as indifferent to religion and his own record as governor. I'm not sure how much that's going to affect that.
Mm. Well, let's move on to the other story. Yesterday, Massachusetts Attorney General Martha Coakley joined 48 other states in agreeing to a settlement with five of the nation's biggest banks over their role in the foreclosure crisis. The banks will pay $25 billion. About $300 million of that will be going to struggling homeowners in Massachusetts. Here's Martha Coakley.
We believe it's a good step, but we also believe it's only one in a continuous path that we fought since 2007 and will continue to do for relief and accountability for homeowners in Massachusetts.
What do you think? Coakley at one point threatened to walk away from this settlement. In the end, she agreed to sign on. Craig Sandler, good decision?
You know, I guess so, yes. So $316 billion, it's better than nothing, which is a bizarre statement.
$316 million, right?
Million,
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Which is a bizarre statement to make about $316 million. But the fact is, I mean, you know, the people, the victims, they each get $20,000 and then another $2,000 payment. It doesn't sound like very much, and I don't think it is, and the reaction hasn't been especially strong.
Yeah, so let's listen to that. Speaking of that, we spoke to a Cambridge lawyer, Paul Collier, yesterday, who's represented homeowners in foreclosure suits. This is what he had to say about the settlement.
In terms of actually punishing banks for the predatory lending and the predatory foreclosing, it's not commensurate with the harm.
What do you think, Dante Ramos? Too little, too late, or do we need to sort of be a little more upbeat about this settlement?
I think we do need to be a little bit more upbeat. I mean, look, it's obvious that there are limits to this settlement. The deal isn't there to resolve every bad thing that happened in the lead up to the 08 crash. And it was never intended to even the score against the banks after all of the bailouts that same fall. It's a response to specific abusive foreclosure practices by specific banks. And almost by necessity, it's going to leave out a lot of loans owned by a lot of other entities. But, you know, hopefully the over $300 million, that's a lot of money. And hopefully the Attorney General will be able to leverage the money for broader relief. And the other thing is that, you know, people underestimate the benefits of ending certain uncertainties and getting things done. Supposedly there's a sign at the Facebook headquarters that says better done than perfect. And I think this is one of those instances.
Yeah. Well, so one of the things that could actually put a little bit of a foundation under the housing market, right?
A little bit is right. Yeah. I mean, I think it's not too little too late. It's probably like too little on time. You know, the timing is fine. Not very much money.
All right, well, let's move on to another big exemption of sorts this week. Washington granted Massachusetts and nine other states waivers from No Child Left Behind. Here's President Barack Obama again on why Massachusetts was allowed to opt out.
So Massachusetts, for example, has set a goal to cut the number of underperforming students in half over the next 6 years. I like that goal.
So this is really the end of an era. No Child Left Behind was signed by President George W. Bush. He had bipartisan support, including the likes of Senator Kennedy. Faced a lot of criticism, though, along the way, that it wasn't funded properly. On the whole, what's the legacy of No Child Left Behind? Craig?
Well, you know, I do think that it actually picks up on the mass education reform of 1993 in that it codifies and operationalizes the idea that, you know, we want specific measurable results. You can talk about the results and whether test scores are, believe me, it's been discussed enough on this air, And I think that that's really the legacy. And I do think it is a good legacy. It, in my mind, I remember well, the Mass Law and then this law really crystallizing the idea that the darn students are the customers. And most enterprises have ways of measuring whether you are making an impact positively on the customer. And I think No Child Left Behind, by you know requiring reporting specifically, partially at least implemented that. So yeah. I think the legacy is mostly positive.
What do you think, Dante Ramos?
I agree completely. I think before No Child Left Behind, there was a tendency in school reforms to be very process-oriented, to say that teachers need to take a certain number of certifications or get a certain type of training for a certain number of hours. And in what that does in practice, it allows even lousy school districts to say that they're doing something positive. Meanwhile, there are whole schools where kids are just not learning. And I think, you know, the thing to remember about these waivers, you know, while it clearly is a walk back from No Child Left Behind, the states to get the waivers had to, you know, had to agree to go forward with certain types of reforms, including, you know, using test scores to evaluate teachers and principals and things like that. So I think, you know, one of the good things that's happened is that No Child Left Behind, it's showing its limits, but a lot of the basic ideas are kind of baked into how we think about education now.
Well, let's move on to a discussion about the budget, Beacon Hill, and taxes. On Wednesday, Speaker Robert DeLeo put a kibosh on one of Governor Deval Patrick's budget proposals, new taxes and fees on candy, soda, cigarettes, and bottled water. Here's DeLeo.
Any changes to revenue policy should be approached with extreme caution and should never be done piecemeal. As such, we will be releasing a budget from the House Committee on Ways and Means that does not rely on any new taxes or any new fees.
So, Craig Sandler, does this, are we seeing, do we have a looming confrontation, I guess, between DeLeo and the governor over taxes and fees?
In an election year, I think the governor will be happy enough to pass up the chance for a lot of confrontation, though I don't really know what the Senate will do. And I know that the Senate actually tends to be more progressive on health issues, including the funding of health issues. So you could do some of this, you know, yeah, tax the candy and use it for health. And the House could wind up yielding to that in conference committee. So I don't think the issue is 100% settled. But now he said, read my lips.
Yeah.
So my guess is that, again, in an election year, this is DeLeo saying we don't need to do it. And by the way, that's another, and I'll do it as I like to do, it's another Craig Sandler ray of sunshine for Meghna's benefit and yours too, Anthony, in that I think it's a sign that we are in really solid shape, comparatively speaking.
Interesting. Briefly, Craig, while I have you on this issue on Beacon Hill, I understand the mood up on the Hill was pretty tense before this speech because of news that former Speaker, now convict, Sal DeMasi is being transported to Boston, and many are speculating it's to testify in a probation department grand jury hearing.
That's
we
right.
don't know this, but can you describe what the mood was like up there?
Okay, good. People are going nuts, and you're right. It's pure speculation, and we do have to say that over and over. On the other hand, I mean, something is clearly up. The facts that are being reported are that DeMasi is in transit, and it's, you know, it seems clear what that means. And it's certainly the fact that people in that building are not talking about contraception. They are talking about who is going to go down. And, you know, you remember that Weir report about the probation department. That wasn't made up. That wasn't speculation. Mm. And this is the, ongoing, literally in the truest sense of the word, prosecution of the implications of that report. And names were named and of sitting reps and senators. So people are really unhappy, unless they didn't do anything wrong, which they're having the time of their lives, of course, because it's
all
quite
right,
a spectacle.
Well, we will continue to follow that. We've got just time now to move on to our hubbub segment, that story that sort of didn't make it above the fold this week. Meghna, let me get you to chime in with your hubbub.
More rays of sunshine just for you, Craig. And actually, Dante, this is the one that echoes something that your boss, Peter Canello, the editorial page editor of the Globe, he was telling us one of his hubbubs last summer was lamenting the closing of so many independent booksellers in Harvard Square, including the Curious George bookstore right in the middle of Harvard Square, where my hubbub is its imminent reopening.
Really?
A young pair of entrepreneurs from Roslindale have gotten approval from NBC Universal and all the, you know, the trademark holders of Curious George to reopen the store at the same spot in Harvard Square. They're going to change the business model a little, but that mischievous little monkey... And I'm not talking about the students, is going to be back in Harvard Square, which is just great news for independent booksellers in Cambridge.
So, good for Harvard Square that a real sort of business with a character is sticking around or coming back in any event.
I love the fact that we're talking about the intellectual property and business model of Curious George.
It's important. Craig, your hubbub.
Well, and let me just say, Bob Slate and Curious George in 1 year in Harvard Square. Those are two good saves, man. That's excellent. Anyway, my hubbub was just a moment on Beacon Hill when DeLeo was making his big speech. And we noticed at the end of the speech that no one had been on the rostrum with him. And we really hadn't noticed it during the speech. And then all of a sudden, wow, what is up with that? Now, DeLeo is, you know, a little bit involved with this probation thing. I'm not making any allegations there. But it was noted that people were not on the rostrum, and it felt either like staging, like I'm going to get all of this space to myself, or like the Group W bench in Alice's restaurant where everyone moved away.
I remember the Group W bench. That's great. Dante Ramos, that leaves you for the hubbub.
Well, I want to praise Linda Chorney, who is the Sudbury native who has a self-released record, which is up for a Grammy this weekend for Best Americana Album. She turns out not to be all that well-known even in her genre, but she used the Grammy Academy, I guess you'd call it, their social networking site, just to ask people to listen to her record. And this was enough to get her a nomination. But it was also enough to get her the wrath of Nashville publicists and other music purists. And it seems to me that when other musicians are using outrageous clothing and sex appeal and bad attitudes and trashing hotel rooms and so forth to get attention, why is the plucky use of social media so wrong? So good luck to you, Linda Chorney.
Dante Ramos, thanks so much. And we're going to go out on Linda Chorney's Broken Promised Land off her Grammy-nominated Emotional Jukebox. Dante Ramos, Deputy Editorial Page Editor for the Boston Globe, thanks for joining us. Come back again.
Thank you.
And Craig Sandler, General Manager of the Statehouse News Service, always great to have you.
I'm using Plucky next time.
Coming up, what's going on with all those beach dolphins on Cape Cod? Stay with us. We'll find out. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.